Hello, and welcome to The Alt Left.
Welcome back, everyone, to The Alt Left. Today is January 22nd, 2021. With me are my co-hosts, Matthew McConaughey.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back.
Full relation. And the good Reverend Dr. K.
Good evening, everyone.
So today we're going to take a little trip down a full-blown topic. Rather than just complaining about the powers that be, we're going to be talking about something that actually affects everyone that's not just Americans, is the climate.
Yep.
This is an issue that is dire, it is problematic, it is deadly, and it is global. And it's political. So before we jump into what we think about it, what needs to be done, what has been done, what is good, what is bad, what is scary, what is polar bears, we need to have a little discussion as to where we are in the world.
We didn't start the fire.
Yeah, kind of did.
Yeah, I mean, fair enough.
There's a whole bunch of people at NASA with the big diggers agree with you, sir. One of the ways we measure this stuff is since the late 1800s, it's since the Industrial Revolution. That's where the carbon damage starts to come from. Before then, we did not have massive coal-burning industries around the world, and man's carbon footprint was basically kept to people who were camping on fires and deforestation, which about evened out with the decrease of the animal population. But once you start making steel and burning coal, that changes. So where are we now? Basically, just to get a couple of facts out of the way, in 2019 was the second warmest year on record. That means since they have started measuring and recording data on what temperature it is outside to see if the queen needs a coat, this was the second warmest year. And it's only the second because it's 2020 and 2016 are tied for the first.
Yeah. And we still don't have all of 2020's data yet. They're still calculating it. We'll know, I think, in February or March for sure.
Yes.
Oh, I think there's no question 2020 is going to be the hottest.
Agreed.
It would be on brand.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's where this basically comes to. You know, in 2019, what we have for sure data is 2019. The average temperatures across the global land and ocean surfaces was 1.71 degrees Fahrenheit above the 20th century average of 57 degrees Fahrenheit. We're not doing Celsius because Celsius is stupid.
Agreed.
We're not measuring when water boils. We're measuring temperature as it relates to human beings.
I don't have any strong opinions on how we measure heat or cold.
As long as you don't call it a thermometer, we're cool.
Oh God, please tell me you don't know anybody that does that.
No.
Okay. I got a question for you that might help. Quick science lesson for all of our listeners out there. Can you guys tell everyone what the difference is between Celsius, Fahrenheit, and Kelvin?
Yes. Celsius is basically a unit of measurement for water. 0 degrees Celsius is when water, at sea level, obviously, because barometric pressure plays a key part in when water boils. If you ever try to make ramen while camping, you know this. but Celsius zero is when water freezes at sea level on Earth. And 100 is where water boils at sea level on Earth, which is why it's a stupid temperature gauge.
And then Fahrenheit is based on... Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, Fahrenheit was just some guy decided to have a scale of measurement for temperature.
Yeah, and it was named after him. His name was Fahrenheit Smith.
Actually, it was John Fahrenheit, which are That's both of those are absolutely wrong.
Yeah.
And then Kelvin, zero Kelvin is absolute zero, which means that there is no more energy to move, and that's a whole nother sciencey thing that is a very long explanation.
There's actually a specific scientific term for that level of cold. It translates from Latin to "it's a bit nippy."
Yeah, and there you go, listeners. That's a thing you know now.
Screw Celsius. Kelvin's great for astronomy. Fahrenheit's what we use here on the planet Earth. But so what we're talking about with this increase is that the annual temperatures around the globe increased at an average of 0.13 degrees Fahrenheit per decade. That's not that it's gone up 0.13 over the last century or since the Industrial Revolution. Per decade since 1880, and it's gone over twice that. It's at 0.32 Fahrenheit since 1981. Since Ronald Reagan came into office, global temperatures have gone way up. Now, some of you may say correlation does not equal causation. And to that, I would say, shut up. Now,
while you may be right, Reagan absolutely had a negative effect on the environment.
He had a negative effect on humanity. But yeah, that 1981 number is important because that's just the very tail end of the 20th century. Nothing happened in 80 and 81. It's just an easy way to measure two decades. But between, again, we take that 1880 number as the Industrial Revolution and when we had good numbers on this, the five warmest years in that bracket of 1880 to 2019 have all occurred in 2015 or since 2015. So since 2015, we've had the five warmest years between the 1880 and 2019, which is insanity. And nine of the 10 warmest years have happened since 2005.
Yep.
Now, from 1900 to 1980, that other bracket we have, a new temperature record was set on average every 13.5 years, right? So on average, again, sometimes it's less, sometimes it's more, every 13 and a half years from 1900 to 80 years, we had a new average record high. Since 1981, it's increased every 3 years. So it's gone from every 13.5 years we had a new record heat to every 3 years. And it's 2.1 degrees higher since that 1980 bracket.
And for those of you listening to this, is kind of where you get this weird shift that happened because we used to, like, the buzzword used to be global warming. And a big thing is there was a lot of pushback from Republicans and stupid people that would be like, it's snowing outside. How could there be global warming? And so they changed the branding to climate change because now keep in mind, nothing really changed scientifically. In all the models we had, we predicted there would be massive fluctuations in temperature. You would see extremes of hot, cold, increases in storms, weird weather patterns, things like that. All this was known, all this was predicted, but because there was no term that implied that, and we just used global warming, a bunch of morons, and they're still here, were like, well, it can't be happening because things are cool today. And so that's kind of where the switch started happening. Climate change came about as an attempt to rebrand global warming.
Yes, even though global warming is still an applicable term, because what we're talking about, and that's why that argument is such a fallacy.
Yeah,
you know, there's that congressperson who brought in a snowball from outside to prove that global warming wasn't happening. And it's like, I mean, when someone says they're hungry, do you tell them they couldn't be because you had a sandwich?
Yeah,
it makes no sense. But
or that there's a sandwich sitting in front of them.
Yeah, so therefore they cannot.
You can't be hungry. There's a sandwich in front of you.
Yeah, there's a deli downstairs. There can be no hunger and famine in the world. It's the same argument. But global warming is still accurate. It's an accurate term because we're talking about an average global rise in temperature. And this is happening for a couple reasons. One of them is CO2 in the air.
Yep.
It creates
greenhouse
effect. Exactly. You get the Earth's rays coming in. They're not bouncing back out. We're trapping in more heat. And this leads to a cascading runaway effect. Okay. So right now, the CO2 per NASA, I checked today, the CO2 level is 415 parts per million. That is the highest number it's been in 650,000 years. Because unlike checking out daily temperatures, we can see what average global temperatures are through the fossil record and through Earth strata. Yeah, carbon leaves footprints.
Sediment, right?
Exactly. Deep sediment layers, plant fossil records. We can find out what the CO2 levels in the air were. And yeah, it is now the highest it's been in 650,000 years, long before humanity. And one of the biggest issues with this is not just the global rise in temperature, because lots of things happen. That's the problem, is this is not a set of dominoes, even though it's a runaway cascade effect, but it is not A leads to B, B leads to C, C leads to D. It is A falls over, and it's more like a pebble in the lake. A wave goes around, and it changes everything. So because CO2 is higher, we get a higher ocean acidification. Now, other things do this too as well, industrial pollution, plastic, but CO2 levels being higher also acidifies the oceans. The oceans are where we get most of our air. We like to think it's trees. More than 60% of the Earth's oxygen comes from the ocean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As those acidity levels rise, that plant life starts to die. Cutting down trees is bad, but the thing is, plants above the ocean floor, like trees, they don't operate like we think they do. They don't breathe like a person. They just suck in CO2 and spit out oxygen. No, they breathe so slowly that it would be several breaths worth in your entire lifetime. They take in, and that's an exaggeration, but they take in air incredibly slowly, and they simply pull the carbon out to build. Trees use, every inch a tree grows is how much carbon it's pulled out of the air. It is not this rapid flux process. It's this incredibly slow process. So cutting down trees isn't necessarily what creates the problem. It's cutting down trees and then burning them. Because not only have you removed a carbon scrubber from the ecosystem, but you've now set alight all that carbon and pushed all that carbon into the air at once. So you burn a tree, and that carbon that was slowly pulled out over decades is back into the air in the matter of an hour. All of this creates greenhouse gases, which heat up the Earth's temperature. And heating up the Earth's temperature by a degree or two doesn't sound too bad when you're just thinking about it. But besides the effect on the plant life and the oxygen levels it's going to create, we're also losing massive amounts of sea ice. The sea ice helps keep the Earth cool. It acts as a reflector. We have these giant ice caps over the poles that actually reflect an ass ton of sunlight. Greenland is actually a big reflector of sunlight. As they melt away, less and less sunlight is getting reflective. And what does that do? Contributes to raising the Earth's temperature. And so this becomes this downward rolling snowball of bullshit. And it's gotten really bad. Right now, let's say NASA says we're currently losing 428 billion metric tons of sea ice per year. And for those of you who live in America, a metric ton is bigger than an imperial ton. It's over 2,000 pounds. So we're losing 428 billion metric tons of sea ice in a year, which is causing an average sea level rise of 3.3 millimeters per year. Again, that doesn't sound like a lot, but we're already talking about over a century. We're talking about hundreds of millimeters at this point. Soon to be higher than that. And this doesn't just raise the beach level slightly. This creates more hurricanes. This creates more storms. This creates more calamity. And all of these things are interchained. This is a giant circle that all affects each other at the same time. And one system failing greatly exacerbates all the other systems. With this, we're also doing things like overfishing the oceans. Most industries are showing that we're driving the tuna population currently extinct right now. It will not be long before they're completely gone. And I hate to break it to you, open a can of tuna. At best, about half of that's actually tuna. Most of that's bycatch. And the problem with this bycatch is when they fish for tuna, they use drag nets that literally go on the entire span of the ocean and drag along the bottom of the ground as well, which scrapes up the kelp beds. It scrapes up the entire ecosystem. And then everything else gets thrown back to die. But we're wiping out swaths of the ocean, which is the oxygen-producing life force and the protein source for a good chunk of humanity as well. So the question is, how do we fix it? How do we put a stopgap in? You know, one of the big things that Trump did to screw us all was pulling us out of the Paris Climate Accords, which was where industrialized nations finally actually agreed to start giving a shit about this in any kind of meaningful way. And just now, one of the first things, and this is one thing I will commend Biden on, he immediately put us back into the Paris Climate Accords.
And again, a lot of detractors are going to come in and say something like, well, it didn't force anybody to do anything and they don't have to adhere to this. But that isn't the point. For the first time on a global scale, the most powerful countries in the world are agreeing to try and do something.
It's not just the most powerful countries in the world. It's 186 countries. And when we join back, it'll be 187. That's out of 209.
Yeah. That it's a big deal. It's a big deal because it is going to take a global effort to reverse the damage we've already done. And anybody out there that's trying to tell you that, well, it isn't confirmed or there isn't consensus, no, that's bullshit. Okay. If there is any scientist out there that is denying this, they either on the payroll of big oil, they are a charlatan of some kind, they are on the take in some way. This is a 100% scientific consensus across the board in multiple fields of science. We're not just talking about climate science. We're talking about geology. We're talking about astrophysics. We're talking about oceanography. Multiple different scientific fields have confirmed this is happening. And so because out of like something that's like 97% of scientists agree it's happening, the remaining 3% are charlatans and hucksters employed by people that have a vested interest in fucking up our climate.
Or, and I rarely say this, morons. There are a ton of climate deniers who just buy into the propaganda.
That's absolutely true.
And they do it in the most disingenuous way. They pull what I call a Joe Rogan would be a good example of this, or Steven Crowder. They come at it from the point of like, well, I'm really open-minded and I'm just asking questions and I'm a skeptic. They're not skeptics. They're not real skeptics. They're pushing an agenda because it makes them money. They don't honestly want to know the truth because the evidence is there. They've all interviewed scientists and people that are knowledgeable about this, people who have studied this, and all of them have told them the facts and they still deny it. And the reason they still deny it and the reason they get away with it is one of the biggest problems in science is scientists are great for giving you hard facts and data. They are terrible at debating and dealing with people that are dishonest. And that's what people like Steven Crowder and, again, Joe Rogan to an extent, I won't say he's as bad as him, but he's up there, and many other people on the right, they're excellent at debating. They're polished debaters, and they don't go into this honestly. They're trying to trip these scientists up, and because these scientists aren't polished at debate skills, they just want to give facts, they get tripped up all the time, and it makes them look bad and ill-informed. They aren't. It just looks bad.
Beyond that, what do we think about the Paris Climate Accords? Obviously, four. Give us a little rundown of what we think about this.
Yeah, Kate, you're a numbers guy. Give us the facts. And you better be good about it, otherwise we're going to call you some names.
And speak in a very offensive French accent while you do it.
Please.
Ooh, I mean, I only care about the people of Paris, so...
I'll call Tom Cruise and let him know right away.
First of all, Paris Climate Agreement has a goal of keeping global warming to no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius. And I know that, you know, we like to use freedom units here on this podcast, but the rest of the world uses Celsius. Yeah, 1.5 degrees Celsius, no more than that from pre-industrial levels. There's 197 nations that all have joined the Paris Climate Accords, and that includes Obama back in September of 2016. Trump withdrew us from the Paris Climate Accords in 2017, and that was official on November 2020. So that only actually happened very, very recently that we were completely withdrawn. And that's also why it's going to take 30 days, even though Biden has signed the executive order to rejoin. It takes a little while to get that thing to happen. Next thing is they want to limit the global temperature rise by reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And 186 countries of the 197 so far have submitted plans for reducing emissions. And most of those plans are effective through 2025 to 2030, depending on who they are. And what does that mean? So there's no set requirements for how much a country has to cut emissions. So the Paris Climate Accord doesn't say that. It doesn't tell you what it has to. And that was kind of one of Trump's arguments towards that. But countries like India, they have pledged to cut emissions by 33 to 35% below 2005 levels, generating 40% of their electricity from non-fossil fuel sources by 2030. The U.S., when we were part of it, we had pledged to cut emissions by 26 to 28% below 2005 levels by 2025. So that's kind of where most countries are in terms of their range of actions. Paris Climate Accord is important, first of all, because it solidifies an idea that global warming is real. And having all of the leaders of 197 nations all saying that this is real and that it's something that we need to pay attention to was landmark. It had never happened before.
I think one of the biggest accomplishments of it was that it caused all the global leaders to not only acknowledge its existence, but actually acknowledge that action was necessary.
Correct.
And we could not survive without immediate action. And that's the first step. You know, ask an alcoholic. Step one is you got to admit there's a problem. And the fact Correct. That we could have a consensus that action was needed, I think was one of the most important features, like the most important things to come out of this.
Correct. And while it doesn't set any expectation of those actions, it did set up clear expectations of measuring those actions, also monitoring, verifying, and reporting those results to the rest of the world. What did Trump do on the in-between, right? So that was something else I just kind of wanted to touch on. He scrapped the Clean Power Plan that was also put into place under Obama that was supposed to reduce emissions by 32% from power generation by 2030. And he replaced it with something that was called the Affordable Clean Energy Rule, which in doing so could create an additional 624 million metric tons of greenhouse gas by 2035. So instead of actually reducing greenhouse gases that were produced by the United States, Trump's official policy that he put into place would have produced more than what we were currently set to do. And that's kind of the reason why it was such a big deal that we as a country left the Paris Climate Accord. Like, it didn't make any sense. Also, the Clean Energy Rule reduced fuel efficiency requirements. And so what that really means is that cars no longer had to have as clean a burning engines, or not necessarily as clean burning, but that it wasn't required that they had that they got as many miles per gallon. So it reduced that.
So total working efficiency is what you mean.
Yeah, total working efficiency. So right now, I don't know what the numbers are, but it basically reduced the amount of miles per gallon that they were required to meet. That could have equated, if it actually was allowed to go into effect, in an extra 1.8 billion tons of CO2 by 2035. Just from this one thing that he changed, which to me, it smacks of such ignorance, I don't even understand. Except that when you think about it, what was he doing with that? What he was trying to do is allow cars to not be as fuel efficient so that we could sell more gas.
Yep.
Because it doesn't matter if people get harmed. It doesn't matter if we destroy our planet, so long as the rich keep getting richer and more money are lining the pockets of people like Trump.
Correct. So there was a study that was done in Nature Climate Change. It's a journal or a magazine. I can't remember exactly what it is. As far as COVID-19 is concerned, we saw a huge decrease in people that were actually driving right at the beginning. And we saw greenhouse emissions decrease by like 17% in the first 4 months in 2020. Unfortunately, that was kind of short-lived and we've kind of gone back up, which is really unfortunate because it reducing them by 17% would have, you know, if we could have continued that, would have put us on a much better trajectory for meeting our long-term goals of reducing our emissions for the Paris Climate Accord.
It's this complete head in the sand mentality. And the thing that has always gotten me about it is the people that are always advocating for these decisions, Republicans, but specifically Republican leadership, by and large, are people that are never going to be around to see the awful that they are helping to create. Like, that's the thing that gets me about it the most. They're all going to live their big old wealthy lives. They're going to die probably comfortably in their beds because there isn't that kind of justice in the world where they get hit by a car or something, or, you know, drown in a tub of toxic sludge. But they'll all end up passing away, and it's the rest of us and our children and their children. They're going to have to deal with the mess they've left, which is exactly what's been happening for our generation. I mean, let's be honest here. Yes, things started getting bad, but it's around the time that the Industrial Revolution happened. But boomers really kickstarted a lot of this stuff into gear a second time around. They basically thrived on one of the best economies and one of the greatest times and decided to just fuck it all up for all of us. you know, and they continue to do so by being the slowest generation to accept the climate science behind all this stuff, to accept that solar and wind are our futures, to accept that nuclear is also an option we need to look at. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and that's, and again, I don't even want to say, I don't even like the, well, they just did it because they'll be dead by then. It was, it's even more insidious than that, because these people got incredibly wealthy destroying the environment. And it's not just that they'll be dead. It's that they also ensured that their families and everyone they care about will be able to ride out the apocalypse with comfort.
Well, and no, and I wasn't trying to argue they did it just because they're going to be dead. I just think it's an additional messed up aspect of this, that they are causing all these problems and they aren't going to have to suffer through them. That's the point I was getting at.
I wasn't insinuating that. I was just adding.
Oh, okay. It sounded like you thought that that's what I was saying, that the only reason they did it is because they were going to die before it.
No, I was just adding to it. But yeah, and I think we have a lot of options. You know, we have an incredible amount. You know, fortunately for us, we were gifted with a gigantic fusion reactor floating just one AU away from us.
Yeah.
Well, it's not really floating. It's actually hurling through space at a death rate. But the point is, there's a gigantic fusion reactor one AU away that shines an incredible amount of energy at us that we can harness with insane ease. I don't want to go into too many. I think that most renewable energy sources are worth it. I am personally, I know the minority in this group, I am not pro-nuclear.
You're wrong, but that's okay.
You keep saying that, but unfortunately, history would disagree with you, sir. Unfortunately, there is no safe nuclear. Now, in perfect honesty, there's no safe coal either. It's not like everything is clean and happy and safe and nuclear is the bad guy. No. It has a pretty decent, you know, when you take into account all of history of it, it's got an incredibly good safety standard in history compared to. But if you want to just talk about the last 30, 40 years, no, it's on par. So the problem is that nuclear accidents don't happen very often. But when they do, they are catastrophic for an incredible amount of time. Unlike a coal fire, the consequences of a nuclear meltdown are incredibly high. And that's the problem. It's not that it's frequent. It's not anything like that. It's that the consequences are far too dire. I mean, hell, look at Three Mile Island, right? Three Mile Island had a fantastic rate of not killing a bunch of people, right? It was probably one of the least of the bad nuclear accidents. Three Mile Island's got one of the best in terms of human life lost. But I mean, cleanup on it started in late 79 and didn't end till 1993. Just the cleanup cost alone was $1 billion, and it caused $2.4 billion in property damage. Without having a fully functioning plant, here in California in Simi Valley, an experimental reactor released an insane amount of radiation to the air when they vented it rather than themselves die. And it actually left permanent poisoning into the mountains there. Now, these are ones that actually didn't kill a bunch of people, though. But what's, no one really talks about these. But then there's like Chernobyl, for instance, right? There's the U.S. Atomic Commission has a rate of 1 through 7 of how bad a nuclear accident is, right? You know, 1 is like an uncontrolled fission experiment goes off, but whatever. You know, and 7 is fucking Chernobyl. So it's Chernobyl's only one of 2 nuclear accidents that have ever been rated as a 7, which is the maximum level on the International Nuclear Event Scale. The other's Fukushima. So the 2 in recent history. Now, the UN Scientific Committee on the Effects of Atomic Radiation actually found with their model predictions with the greatest confidence values, which is what they said, which are basically of the scientific statistical analysis, the ones that actually held water and were found to be reliable sources of data, right? The eventual total exposure-related deaths in the decades since Chernobyl releases vary from about 9,000 fatalities, and that's only if you're counting the 3 most contaminated former Soviet states. If you include Eastern Europe, the number jumps to an average of 16,000 deaths, directly resulting in the decades after Chernobyl from the exposure to the airborne radiation. That's 16,000 civilians, not even power plant workers, because of this. Now, the NEA, the Nuclear Energy Agency, they did a report. I've got the title here. It was Per Chernobyl Assessment of Radiological and Health Impact, right? The initial emergency response together with later decontamination of the environment, which is the actual sarcophagus itself and surrounding pre-put, ultimately involved more than 500,000 people. It cost an estimated 18 billion rubles, which is 68 billion U.S. dollars adjusted, just to clean it up. Now, at Chernobyl, it's the approximate radius they use for it is 100,000 square kilometers, which is, for us Americans, 39,000 square miles. That much land was considered significantly contaminated with fallout. Now, it's not a real problem in rural Ukraine, but most effective nuclear power plants are going to be in metropolitan areas, especially now. If we're talking about nuclear as a replacement source for dirty fuel and for fossil fuels, right? Which is, I think, where we're going with this. These are in metropolitan areas. These are going to be in New York, Los Angeles, San Diego, Cincinnati, Paris. You know, these are going to be in population-dense areas that require an ass ton of power, right? So, and this is very famous where they talk about the Red Forest was what was around there while the trees died. Now, that is obviously bounced back, but that is the effective kind of radiation fallout we're talking about. What we lucked out on is that because of the weather pattern that happened right when Chernobyl popped, most of the fallout landed on mountainous regions like the Alps and the Welsh Mountains. And they actually, believe it or not, the Scottish Highlands got quite a bit of it. But because that's where the weather blew it, it actually didn't have a big human impact outside of the nearby area. And I've actually got some facts here. Again, if we're going to substitute kind of animals for people on this one, a lot of the animals in the worst hit areas in that local range either died or completely stopped reproducing. Most domestic animals were removed from the exclusion zone, but not all. A lot of horses were left. And when they were found, to be inspected later after the fires were out, they were found they died because their thyroid glands were destroyed by the radiation doses in the whole area. Now, some cattle on the same island died. Those that survived were stunted because of thyroid damage. Again, this is the typical damage done by nuclear accidents. Luckily, the next generation that came from them appeared to be normal. It was not passed on. That radiation damage only existed to them. It did not go into their offspring. But in that area in Ukraine, this is just in Ukraine, from 86 to 1990, nearly 350 animals were born with gross deformities, such as missing or extra limbs, missing eyes, heads or ribs, or deformed skulls. Now, 350 animals doesn't sound like a lot, but in comparison to the average, only 3 abnormal births of that type had been recorded in 5 years before. So it went from 3 in 5 years to 350 in 4 years. That's a significant jump. The area around 30 kilometers, which is 19 miles in all directions from the plant, is actually called the Zone of Alienation. Some of it's been opened back up for tours near the sarcophagus, but that entire land will not ever, in any reasonable time, be able to be inhabited on. In fact, right now, people who work near the sarcophagus are only allowed to work 5 hours a day for 1 month before taking 15 days consecutively of rest afterwards to lower themselves in the radiation. But that was the beauty of Chernobyl, is when it went off, it was in a rural area. But let's fast forward to Fukushima, right? This plant was built on an active seismic hotbed in a tsunami zone. What could go wrong, right? In July 5th of 2012, the Diet of Japan, which is basically their Congress, they did a Nuclear Accident Independent Investigation Commission, the NAIIC, found that the causes of the accident had been foreseeable and the plant operator, Tokyo Electric Power Company, had failed to meet basic safety requirements such as risk assessment, prepping for containing collateral damage, and flood control. Do you see a pattern here? Because what this is not that nuclear reactors are inherently going to melt. It's human error every time, whether you're talking about Three Mile Island, whether you're talking about Simi Valley, whether you're talking about Fukushima, whether you're talking about Chernobyl, or God, I can't remember the other name of the Russian one that actually dumped the most amount in the air that's ever existed. These were always human error, laziness, and corruption. And it's one thing to pin it on the Soviets for that, but the Japanese did that too. And they're considered one of the safeties. They were considered one of the safest and most responsible, like right up there with the Finnish on nuclear power. And if we're going to talk about human impact, the World Health Organization did a report in 2013, 2 years after this happened, right? that there was a 0.75 pre-accident lifetime risk of developing thyroid cancer has now increased to 1.25%. That's almost double. That's the single greatest increase in thyroid cancer that's to any event, period. And then lastly, in I can't pronounce the name. It's Namie, right? This is the town that was evacuated, that was nearby. It's kind of Japan's Pripyat, right? 21,000 people were evacuated. And a screening program a year later in 2012 found that more than a third, 36% of the children in Fukushima prefecture have abnormal growths in their thyroid glands. As of 2013, there were more than 40 children newly diagnosed with thyroid cancer and other cancers in Fukushima prefecture as a whole. In 2015, the number of thyroid cancers or detection of developing thyroid cancers numbered 137. Now, we don't know this is recent. We can't predict exactly where these numbers are going to end up. But what we can do is compare them to the rates of childhood thyroid growth and what is happening right there. The early data from Chernobyl, it showed that their quote was, there was an unmistakable rise in thyroid cancer rates following the disaster in 1986, did not start until a cancer incubation period of 3 to 5 years. This is the issue with nuclear. It doesn't produce carbon, and new reactors can actually burn some of the old nuclear waste you had going around, and that's amazing, the Gen 4 reactors. But when there's a problem, the human consequences are insane, and the land is destroyed. When there is a coal plant fire, it gets fixed. We move on. I am not advocating for coal. I am advocating that nuclear is not a viable option in metropolitan areas to replace grid storage.
You're wrong. Everything you just mentioned is absolutely accurate. That is why nuclear is the boogeyman of today. That's why nobody wants it. That's why no one wants to do it. You are talking about three major plant disasters plus the one incident in Simi Valley over the entire history of nuclear. Okay. The track record is still better than any of our fossil fuels. They don't even come close to that. They were big and they were bad, but over the span of our energy consumption, fossil fuels, gas, all that stuff have killed and harmed the environment way more than anything nuclear has done.
Yeah, but that's a false dichotomy. I'm not suggesting that fossil fuels are safer.
And I'm not done yet. Okay. So that's something to keep in mind, because in the context of this, if you're going to point to a boogeyman, the real one is the one we're already using.
Yes, but again, no one's talking about fossil fuels.
I'm getting to that. You've got to let me make my point. The reason I'm bringing that up is to give people something to put it against. Because when you just talk about how bad nuclear is without putting it in the context of other fossil fuels that we're using, of course nobody's going to want to try it, okay? And yes, you're right. Nuclear by itself is safe. The issues have been human error. Mm-hmm. But the more important thing to focus on is the human errors caused a runaway chain reaction that caused a meltdown. All the current technologies being developed are specifically designed to negate that. So what I mean is the nuclear reactions in these plants got so out of control that normal methods of cooling weren't enough to slow it down, or the methods of cooling broke down because of the human error and couldn't work. What's being developed now are multiple different small-scale nuclear reactors, which are much safer, much easier to be contained. So in the event of a meltdown, which these are the ones that are looking at for the more city-based, the design of them is inherently made so that even if human error were to occur, the likelihood of a meltdown is significantly less than what we've already seen in any of these. And even if it happened, the way they are built, the radiation would not escape the containment.
But that's the exact argument that was told about Fukushima being built. Fukushima was the same way. It was built so that even if it failed, the radiation would not exit, and they willingly had to vent it.
And no, it was not. So Fukushima was not one of these new reactors. It's an older model. It's something that was left over, I think, from the 60s or 70s. It's not a new design in any way.
And it was from the 70s.
Yeah. And again, that's part of the problem, is people don't want to invest in it or put money towards it because they're terrified of it. And again, I get it. I'm not blaming them for that. Everything that you've mentioned up to this point is horrible. There are new technologies coming out all the time, and some of the top ones right now. So the first one is the small modular reactor technologies, SMRs. Those are the ones that I was just talking about. They're the first ones. There's also light water reactor technologies. The way they're designed is they cool down with less coolant overall. There's also newer ones, the pebble bed ones. These are nuclear reactors that are designed to be cooled. They don't need water. It's gas cooling. So you don't need a ready supply of water to do it. They cool more efficiently and faster than they work. Okay, I know you're a little more versed on the mechanics of those than I am.
Yeah, so that particular type uses a fuel that's encapsulated in, I believe, a ceramic material. And so that bed of material doesn't heat up the same way as the current technology, which is basically that the rods that they have that are graphite encapsulated are actually sunk into a medium that cools it with water around that, right? And it's that heating of that water that actually drives turbines that produce power. That's how it works, right?
It's how fission reactors operate.
Except that that's not how these new reactors actually operate. They operate at much lower temperatures. They operate much cooler overall. They require less cooling, and they are made so that even if they had some sort of meltdown, that they are contained much better. It's something that literally would like come in on a truck and be set down. It is in terms of how much power they produce, where the average reactor now produces anywhere between like 500 to 1,000 megawatts per hour. These new reactors produce like 300. Okay, so yeah, they take more of them, but they're way safer. They're way more efficient, and they can burn they can use all kinds of fuels that they couldn't use before because they needed much higher temperatures, so they needed much more potent fissionable material.
But it's still fissionable material. That's the point you're not getting. I don't care that it's safer than coal. I was never making the argument that it wasn't.
Well, no, you kind of were.
I was making the argument that it's not as safe as solar.
Okay.
Coal was never the issue, and I've admitted 100 times here, coal is the worst thing ever, and burning fossil fuels is the absolute worst thing for the planet. Comparing nuclear to fossil is a straw man argument, because no one here in this conversation, not any of the three of us, are suggesting that nuclear is not better than coal.
Nobody's saying that you're suggesting that. The reason we are mentioning it is for the people listening us so that they can have some context for all the things that you mentioned, which again, as we've mentioned, are true. I'm giving context. I'm not saying that you're saying it's more dangerous.
You literally started off with saying you're wrong and here's why, and then went on to coal.
My wording aside, that was incorrect. And if that's what you took from it, that's not what I meant. Okay, the reason I'm comparing it to other fossil fuels is so that people listening to you can get some context with all the scary stuff you're saying versus what we're actually using. I'm not suggesting you're making that argument. I'm well aware that you were not making that argument. I'm simply saying, for anyone listening who is hearing what you're saying and thinking, oh my God, this is the worst thing ever, I'm giving context.
Yeah, and it's not the worst thing ever. It's the second worst thing ever.
Okay, well, here's the thing. Let's look at some numbers in terms of tons of CO2 per gigawatt hour produced.
Mm-hmm.
So all the way down at the right-hand side is wind. Okay, it's like 50 tons of CO2 per gigawatt hour. Then you have hydroelectric, and then you have nuclear. So it's third. And they're all actually about the same in terms of CO2 per gigawatt hour.
Yeah.
And then you have biomass, which is slightly higher, about double. And then you have solar, and then you have solar, which is about 100 tons of CO2 per gigawatt hour. Then we go on to the real bad polluters, where we look into like natural gas. It's about 450 tons of CO2. Oil, which is about 875 tons. Of CO2, coal, which is 840 tons, 850 roughly. And then you have lignite, which is brown coal, which is the worst producer of CO2 gas, which is around 1170 or 1075.
Is that even burned here in the United States anymore?
Yes, we still have some plants that burn lignite coal. Not everything has been switched over to quote unquote clean coal, which is fucking bullshit.
It's total bullshit.
the difference between lignite, brown coal, and coal, which is what they would consider clean coal, is like 175 tons of CO2 per gigawatt hour. Okay, so as far as talking about solar and talking about greenhouse gas emissions, it's like four times less the amount of CO2 per gigawatt hour produced, even with these old systems that are less efficient, are much worse for the environment.
Can I point something out there?
Sure.
That footprint you're talking about is including production based off of plants that are burning coal.
No.
Yes. If you power factories building solar cells with
emissions intensity of energy sources, this is has nothing to do with the means of production. This is how much they actually produce versus total cost.
Are you telling me that solar cells are off-gassing CO2 by producing electricity?
No, but yes. So it's all of the downstream cost.
Okay, so then it is the production and downstream cost. We're not talking about the production only of electricity, and that's the difference. They are not off-gassing CO2 by producing electricity.
Okay, but hold on. Solar also, it's not just downstream, it's upstream as well. Mm-hmm. Because solar has a lot of waste after the fact. What happens when these new solar panels only last 10 years and they have to be replaced? So they go into a landfill. They don't get recycled.
So then shouldn't we actually do something about legislating and working on the science of recycling them as well?
Well, hold on. You're absolutely right. And that's something we need to touch on a little bit. But sticking with the nuclear topic, and again, one thing I want to clarify here, nuclear is a step. Anyone advocating for nuclear as the solution is an imbecile. The solution is to get wind and solar.
Yeah, I'm not advocating for nuclear being the
I know you're not.
End all, be all.
But most nuclear advocates are.
Are. And that's the problem.
That's the problem. If we're going to have nuclear power plants away from the city centers for a decade or two to switch us to solar and wind, I'm here for that. I actually really am. Yeah. What I'm not here for is fissionable material in populated areas as our source of power. The problem is the nuclear industry is absolutely advocating for that.
The new plants, these 300 megawatt hour plants, don't have fissionable material. They cannot go critical.
Then how are
not
they?
In the same not in the same manner in which old style. They don't melt down.
But there's a difference of they do not melt down, they cannot melt down for, oh, well, they don't have fissionable material. The thing is, you keep going back and forth. You keep saying they don't have material, they can't melt down. And then, well, they're not in the same way and through different safety measures. It's like it's one or the other.
And this is just a misunderstanding of terms. So fissionable, anything that can create a nuclear reaction by definition is fissionable. That is where you're incorrect, Kay. That is where Chris is correct. Where Kay is correct is that the type of fission reaction that is being created is a different type than what has been typically created in everything from Fukushima on back. And so, so that's really where we are. I got what you were saying, but we're getting stuck on the definition, and they are fissionable materials. Absolutely. 100%.
And you're
right. I was misspeaking.
I will take your statement that it is far safer. I have looked into the new reactors. They're amazing. They really are. But you have two problems. One, nothing is foolproof. End of fucking story. And the argument you're making requires an ass ton of absolute ideas. It cannot happen. Cannot. Bullshit. It absolutely can happen. Is it less likely? Absolutely. 100% agree with you. It is not impossible. Number two, my reaction, and I am a far saner, more scientific-minded person than most people who are anti-nuclear, you're going to have this incredible knee-jerk emotional reaction against nuclear. So why worry about it if we're this close to renewable fuel? Germany has produced half of their energy already every year now by renewable sources.
There's lots of countries that have produced all of their power.
Well,
but they have much lower needs than the United States.
They also have much lower land mass than the United States and lower populations. Yeah,
and that's exactly what I was going to say. We can't just plop down a bunch of solar wherever.
You can. You can put it on everyone's fucking roof.
Well,
it's like saying you can't feed a larger population because you can't just have more farms.
So
yes, you can.
So this is where some of the barriers to come in. First of all three of us agree the end goal here is 100% renewables, solar, wind,
yeah,
all those, right?
The end goal is clean, renewable with proper grid storage.
Cool. Great. So some of the barriers that we have, one is investment. There needs to be a huge worldwide multi-government investment in these renewables. And there hasn't been.
Correct.
Because, you know, that's been one of the biggest. It's government funding and policies, period. The government needs to go after this. Like we were talking in our last podcast where we talked about how, you know, we basically came out of World War II as the heroes because we built industry. We basically created this entire war effort. It needs to be that level of dedication. That's
absolutely.
Infrastructure is another issue. Our entire infrastructure right now is built around gas and fossil fuels. Yep. We need to build infrastructure again. That comes from the government.
Well, do you remember Obama when he first started issuing government funding and rebates for solar and the insane pushback from the, like, every senator was against him because they were all being paid for by coal lobbies and fuel lobbies. It was insane.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. The next, so you get past those and then you've got the more science-based issues. So the first one, and this is the main one you're going to hit with solar, is efficiency. So right now, the best we're getting on commercial, and when I mean to commercial, I mean like industrial level. I should say industrial level.
Yeah,
is about 18 to 22% efficiency. Now, in lab, it's a little bit higher. I think the highest in labs right now is something around 48% efficiency. What we mean by that is, in a lab, 48% of the energy absorbed is converted and used. All right, outside of the lab, the best we can get is 22%. It's nowhere near enough. Okay. I think the Goldilocks zone for this is somewhere in upwards of like 70%.
I thought it was like 40.
No.
I don't know. We're nowhere near it, but I thought it was like 40 or 50 was where we're good.
At 40, the cost, I think, comes down enough where it becomes more commercially, where like you can really start selling it to people commercially.
Yeah. It becomes profitable at 40. Maybe that's what I'm thinking of. Yeah.
But 70 is like 70 and above is really where we need to shoot for. And it's a hard mark to get. We're literally talking about doing something that nature took millions and millions of years to accomplish with plants. And it, like, as you said, it doesn't do it efficiently. It's slow. We're trying to jumpstart what nature took millions of years to do and do it better. It's freaking hard.
Mm-hmm.
With that in mind, though, we're getting there. The jumps, because we've been investing into it and because there's now greater demand because prices are coming down, people are investing more in it and we're getting better results, which is why my first thing was government needs to put money into this. All right. That's the first barrier you have. And again, I'm talking strictly about solar here. So bear with me. We'll get into wind in just a little bit. The next issue that you have is storage, because as everyone here knows, and as Republicans are so fond of mentioning, the sun eventually goes down. The way you deal with that and mitigate those issues is storage batteries. Okay. We are way behind, and this is globally. This is not anything unique to the US. Globally, our battery technology is completely subpar. The best we have right now is the big Tesla batteries that have been talked about in news. I don't know if anybody's heard about it. He had a whole plant that he had to build and they kept getting funding because they were getting so many pre-orders that they couldn't build. Like, I think it was something like some weird, like 5-year backlog once the plant was even built, which was still like 3 years away.
Yeah.
And those batteries, while they will be the best that are on the market, are still nowhere good enough.
Yeah. Nowhere near it. Yeah. Our battery technology is nowhere near where it needs to be.
And I don't want to get into the scientific stuff about it because then we have to start explaining what kilowatt hours are and all that. I'm not going to go that depth. There's tons of info out there. If you guys want to look for it, I recommend looking it up and just deep diving. You'll spend hours doing it. It's a rabbit hole, but it's worth it. But the point is that you need to basically store enough store enough energy on the back end to not only get you through the night, but ideally last you in case we have like a series of long-term storms. Like ideally what you want is to be able to survive on your battery for, you know, days or weeks or months. We're nowhere near that level yet, and we need to.
Yep.
So those are the big ones. And of course, the last one, which if you take care of all the other things I've mentioned, this will be resolved by itself, is cost. There's nowhere near enough. It's still cheaper to burn fossil fuels than it is to go solar. Now that's changing.
Yeah, we're getting there.
Yeah. And if you take care of all the other things I mentioned, you'll absolutely bring down the cost, but that's the big barrier. So while all that is happening, while we're doing that, we need to add, that is the end goal. So it's kind of like, to use an example from our last podcast, I think it was, where you were saying communism is the end goal. That's what we're striving for, right? To parrot that, it's the same thing here. This is where we need to be on the road to get there, because again, with government funding and investing, that can be mitigated, but the time it's going to take to get the efficiency and storage taken care of is still significant. I think conservative estimates as a best guess are something in the neighborhood of like 15 years to where we need to be. And that's if everything goes right and we're still guessing conservative. That's not going to happen. That's where nuclear comes in. And that's
the science will move faster than the lawmakers.
Exactly. And that's where nuclear comes in, because we already have we can get nuclear, even these new reactors, off the ground quicker than we can getting to where we need to be with solar and wind. And so that's where the advocates come in. There's also one other thing I wanted to mention that we didn't talk about. We mentioned fissionable materials. So what we're getting now, the power that we get is from nuclear fission. And that's essentially splitting atoms, okay? That's how we're getting this energy. We split the atoms.
That's how it works in a weapon.
but again, it's the same process. Is you're basically splitting apart larger atoms into smaller atoms. Again, yeah. I'm giving it, that's a layman's thing. Again, I'm trying not to get too sciencey with it to make it palatable. Another thing that we're working on, and we're making great strides, we're not where we need to be yet, is nuclear fusion. You've heard it talked about in a lot of like, you know, sci-fi movies where you talk about cold fusion and things like that. That's not what we're talking about here. Cold fusion, for all intents and purposes, is still basically a myth.
It's made out of unicorn farts.
Exactly. where that comes from is some scientists back in the day claimed they were able to accomplish it, and literally no one has been able to reproduce the results ever since. Most people think it's a dead end. But nuclear fusion is what's literally happening in the sun. It's where you're taking smaller atoms and combining them into bigger ones. Essentially, we have now been able to create small amounts of nuclear fusionable energy. The problem that we have with that is it takes more energy now to get the reaction going than that we actually get back from the reaction.
Yeah, it has taken us half a century to even be able to get to almost zero buoyancy, where it almost evens out. And that's why I actually don't believe that fusion is even going to pull off in the foreseeable future at all. I think that is science fiction.
I don't think it will be used for mass producing energy for us. I still think wind and solar are the way to go. However, technology like fusion engines to power spacecraft, which I know sounds very science fictiony, but it's absolutely 100% in the realm of possibility, especially once we're able to harness it and control it. And you got to get into things like, you know, plasma containment and things like that. It's really sci-fi out there stuff, but it's completely within the realm of scientific fact. Absolutely. But it needs to be explored as well. It's still so far out that we'll have figured out solar and wind well before we figure this out. But it's also stuff we need to invest in as well. And I just wanted to mention that as an aside. Some people will talk about it like it's already here and we're going to do it. No, it's not. But it's still worth pursuing, because you don't get meltdowns from nuclear fusion. When you control the reaction like that, it doesn't melt down. In fact, what you want is for the reaction to keep going, and you stabilize it within a field of plasma.
Yeah, and that is actually one of the things that's great, is you can't have a cascading effect of fusion, because that's the problem, is fission. Classic nuclear fissionable material, if you pull the plug and stop everything, that's where you get a meltdown, because you're talking about actually putting rods of fissionable material close enough to each other. That's where the heat comes from, to heat up water. With fusion, you actually have to pump energy into it to even get a reaction, and you have to continue to pump to sustain one.
Yeah.
As soon as you pull the plug, the reaction is over.
Yeah. And then that's where the problem is because we're pumping more energy in than we're getting back. However, the math and the physics here are sound. If you can get it down and get the technology to where it needs to be, you can conceivably get a situation where you're pumping in less energy and getting out more. And once we get that, oh, Nelly,
yeah,
possibilities are endless. But anyway, that was just an aside. Going back to the renewables, the next one that you have on the list that we absolutely need to be pursuing is wind. And despite what certain congressmen might believe,
but it will slow the air down.
Wind is not a finite resource.
I have been told windmills cause cancer.
No. Let's say it again for those in the back. Wind is not a finite resource. Does it stop blowing sometimes? Absolutely.
See? But
the way that wind turbines are designed, even with a minuscule, undetectable by human senses amount of wind, can turn the propeller.
It was windy last week in my neighborhood, and now it is not. And clearly, we have run out of nature. Checkmate, liberal.
But that's one of the. When I heard that, I was just like, this is why we can't have nice things. Windmills are absolutely a viable resource. The biggest barrier with wind is that it's
got to be windy.
Windy, that's one of them. But like I said, they're so efficient, and we're getting to the point now where even minuscule amounts, if you put them high enough, you're still going to get it. We can be down on the ground and not feel a thing, and you'll see them turning, and we'll still be generating energy.
And here's the thing. I think that wind is fantastic. I think you're completely right. It's one of the most efficient, safest, cleanest forms of energy there is. I think the thing is not to look at, well, are we going to go solar? Are we going to go wind? Are we going to go hydro? It's like, I think we need to do it all.
All of it.
Yeah. The answer is yes.
Yeah.
Yes, we need to absolutely do everything.
Is it windy and mountainous? Put up windmills. Is it sunny? Put up solar. Do all of it.
We're here on the West Coast. Let's use wave. They're not as efficient or good, but let's invest in the technology to make them there. It's like I said in one of our earlier ones. One of the biggest things that has always gotten me about this country is whether you are left or whether you are right, we are the biggest, blusteriest people when it comes to how great we freaking are. This is our chance to prove it. Okay? If we are truly the greatest nation on earth, like so many of you claim, then not only should we be able to do this, but we should be able to do it better, faster, and more efficiently than everybody else out there. And let's start trying. Let's beat them all to the punch. Because right now, I guarantee you, China's already getting to the point where they're about to abandon they're in their industrial phase right now, and they're already leaving it in the dust. They're progressing at a faster rate than we have been.
Yep.
And part of the problem is because we're still in this 1950s mindset, and we can't get out of it. You know, everyone talks about how polluted China is. Yeah. And they're also farther along in environmental conservation than we ever have been.
Yeah. Because they built all their coal plants, by the way, because of us. Like that's something else. We like to pretend that like India and China are these great polluters for no good reason, not because we didn't ship over all our manufacturing and pay them to do it. They didn't come up and usurp the clean energy. All we did was dump our dirty laundry on the other side of the fence.
Well, and that's the biggest complaint from all the other nations is we did all these dirty energy things, coal, oil, all of it. It's what made us what we are. That was our revolution, is we basically invested in this and polluted. And once we got past that point, then we started telling everyone, oh no, you can't do this. And all these other underdeveloped countries that are trying to have their shot at the economic prosperity that we are by industrializing are now like, well, fuck you. No, we deserve our shot too. We're here in poverty. You already got your success. It's our turn.
And on top of that, not only are we denying them the same opportunities that we created, we are paying them to do them. Like, it's not even that we're just saying, no, you shouldn't do that because we made a mistake and now we know better. We're saying we did it, we made money off it, and now we're going to pay you to do it, and then we're going to give you crap for it.
This is what our foreign policy has been. It's the most, we are constantly accusing other nations of all these human rights violations. And we still have issues with Nazis here in our goddamn country and bigotry and racism.
And the largest captive prison population and slavery population in the world.
Exactly. It's the most ludicrous, hypocritical bullshit I've ever experienced. We haven't adhered to this whole, the older you get, the more conservative you get, because we were brought up and educated well enough that we realized that this is bullshit. Conservatives are full of crap. That's why we keep going more left, because reality in all its form and glory has a left lean, because the left values science, empirical data, and facts more so than the right. I'm not going to say completely, but more so than the right. That's why reality has a left tilt. And that's why anybody who considers themselves a a critical thinker that values facts over their own emotions will typically lean left.
So, you know, I think personally, one of our greatest challenges is grid storage. And what I mean by grid storage, what that term replies is, it's kind of like what Matt was saying earlier, how sometimes the sun sets, sometimes the wind doesn't blow, you know, and what do you do with a solar bay? If a certain area has solar power, right? What do you do at night if you're not going to burn coal and all of us hippies are going to make you not burn nuclear? What do you do at night? And that's, you have to store the energy, but like Matt and Kay were saying earlier, batteries are not efficient. Not only are they not great for storing long-term, they're heavy, it's hard to make them portable, and they have an insane carbon footprint and pollution rate when they're done. So we have to look into green forms of grid storage where you can actually store your power locally, because you can't just plug something in and ship electricity 18,000 miles away. You lose
it. Doesn't work.
Yeah. You cannot insulate a line that well. It does not happen. You lose your power. And there's a couple that I really like. Like one of them is compressed air. Where they're talking.
I haven't heard about it, really.
Well, compressed air, not classical compressed air. What this is actually using like old mines and actually compressing air in these old mine shafts to incredible degrees, containing it, and then at night it gets slowly released through turbines.
Huh, I hadn't heard about that. That's
yeah. Depending I've on the method is 60 to 90% efficiency. And liquid air is kind of a more advanced and personally I think more viable.
It takes a lot more power to make liquid air.
Yes.
And
but I mean
like,
even
I just don't know that we have that much surplus during the day.
Right now we're talking about a 70% efficiency.
No, I understand it's 70% efficient. My question is how much excess power do we actually have during the day to power liquid air production?
Well, even with 24-hour cities, we burn way less power at night.
Yes, no, of course. But we have to generate the liquid air during the day to use at night.
And that is fair.
I just don't see that we have that much excess power during the day to make liquid air. The electricity cost has got to be 5 times as much to make liquid air than it is to make just compressed air.
Yeah, and one of the other ones that they're actually talking about for big cities is using electric vehicles. You have your plug-in, either hybrid or better, a fully electric vehicle, and what they're talking about is everyone plugs it in, you completely charge your car during the day, and you leave it plugged in, and cars can actually be drained and refilled over the night. And they would operate as a million tiny batteries. Now, I don't know where the science lies on where that wears batteries. I mean, there's flywheel technology, which just doesn't work at all. But hydrogen is another good one.
Oh, like hydrogen battery technology? Is that what you're talking about?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, as a storage medium, yeah.
Real quick, though, about the cars, right? Specifically about the cars. Doing that with car batteries, like any lithium ion battery, is a death sentence, right? And
that's what I was wondering. Is that put just too many miles on the battery at that point? Is it just wear it down super quick?
It's not miles.
I mean, miles colloquially.
Okay.
Talking about cycles of draining and refilling. Yeah.
Is every time you drain and charge a battery is one less time that it can be drained and charged. Okay, and every time you drain and charge a battery, the amount that it is charged up to and the amount that it can drain down to is reduced every time. Okay, so the more times you do it, the shorter the amount of time that battery will be viable. So instead of getting 5 years out of a battery, if you were to drain it and charge it multiple times a night to use this as grid storage, you would destroy a battery in a matter of a year or two maximum.
Yeah, I had read on that, but I wasn't sure what the effectiveness of it. And I mean, there's a whole bunch of fringe ideas. I mean, some of them are, you know, pushing weighted trolleys uphill with the power and then letting them slowly come down.
Oh, they already do that. Yeah. They do that with trains.
Yeah, which is neat. I don't know if it works for a massive scale. And again, I think much like, what are we going to do? Sure, we can have a little bit of air. I honestly, in my opinion, as a scientist, My layman opinion is that I actually think that hydroelectricity is the way to go. I actually think draining and refilling dams, pumping water from one side of a dam to the other, is actually one of the ways to go, because you want to talk about 100% efficiency or damn near it on storage. You can literally pump a body of water over a dam and it will hold there, not losing any energy. And then you release it through turbines back onto the other part. And I think
it's true, but it's also very environmentally destructive.
Yeah, that's so that there's two things. It's environmentally destructive, first of all, because you have to have massive amounts of land to do this in. And secondly, it's really inefficient because every time you move the water back and forth, the amount that it evaporates is massive. Okay.
Well, and what we're talking about, though,
that, you have to have huge amounts of water to replenish that.
Yes, but what I'm talking about is not creating new, again, a little bit of everything. This doesn't work everywhere, but we're talking about, there's actually been a lot of success lately of converting current existing hydroelectric dams, like the Hoover Dam is one of them. It's actually pretty easy to convert an old hydroelectric dam into a grid storage dam. You already have a self-replenishing body of water. You already have it tied up. Like, the environmental damage has already been done.
Agreed. But pumping it or letting it produce electricity and then pumping it back so that you can
it doesn't later. Produce electricity anymore. It's grid storage. You get your electricity from solar and wind and whatever, and then you literally pump it from one side to the other. And then at night, when that solar goes away, you then slowly release it to the other side and you have your power storage.
I understand what you're saying. It requires too much land. Like, you can't just pump water around and not have a massive amount of area to store it.
Yeah, again, that's why we're not talking about building new dams. We're talking about converting existing dams.
You can't convert an existing dam into that kind of grid storage. Water behind a dam flows downhill. That's it. You create a giant lake underneath it that's going to drain and fill over and over, like, it doesn't work.
I got a report from the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, and they actually completely disagree. An investment cost of $69 per kilowatt capacity would upgrade most existing hydroelectric dams to proper grid storage.
Then you're not explaining what they mean by that.
Probably not. I'm not a scientist.
Well, and again, that's kind of the reason why I wanted to try to not get too delved into the science part of it, because none of us are science educators. None of us are scientists. We have a better than average understanding of science than I think the average American does, but we are by no means experts. And so if we're going to get lost in this, we're going to misspeak.
True. I think, you know, without showing my hand for my white guy takeaway, like, I think that, you know, hell, I'm just going to do my white guy takeaway. That's what I get from this, is that we have two problems. We need to work on green grid storage because the science to renewable energy is already there. It's working. It's not 100%. I'm not saying that we are mission accomplished, done. I'm saying the right people are doing the right things. The gears are moving. The hamsters are running in the wheels, and we are moving in the right direction. What we are lacking is ways to store clean energy, and especially the political will to build and utilize these infrastructures.
Well said.
What do you think, Kay?
I think the political will is the largest component of this. Scientifically, you know, and as far as industry is concerned, we're doing it. We're trying. There are people working on more efficient batteries, supercapacitors that have much higher density of storage. We're working on, you know, higher efficiency for solar panels and wind turbines and all of that stuff. What we need is leadership in this country that accepts that this is a problem and is going to make a plan to combat it.
And fight windmill cancer once and for all.
Exactly.
All right, Don Quixote. Matt, what do you think? Tilt them windmills.
So, yeah, of course, I, as always, I tend to agree with you guys. I think to go even further down the rabbit hole with that, how do you get political leaders to be motivated? By motivating their base.
guillotines.
Well, that's one way, of course. I think the big thing is also getting people to understand this. Science education is so crucial. It's one of the things that I always will get on a soapbox about. This country is far below where it needs to be as far as science scientific literacy. That's why you get things like the anti-vaxxer movement and flat earthers and people against the moon landing, is because they don't know. They don't understand it. And if you need to educate the general public about this and inform them how crucial it is, and get them not only knowledgeable about this stuff, but also motivated to getting involved, calling their leaders, calling their elected officials, and making them take action.
And I think the best step of that is honestly creating a culture that respects the science again, because it's okay, I'm sure you've heard this term. I've been told this by mechanics, of someone knowing just enough to screw everything up.
Yep. Oh yeah.
And that's a lot where the science denial and anti-vaxxing stuff comes from. It doesn't come from someone who knows nothing of science. Someone who knows nothing of science is just someone who needs to read some science. It's when someone has a wrong idea of the fundamental building blocks of science. You know, someone who hops on their satellite connected smartphone to say that technology is evil.
It's, you know, just enough to be dangerous.
Just enough that crappy and false talking points, which are geared to make the semi-educated jump down that rabbit hole. And that's what we need to do. I agree with Matt 100%. We absolutely need to push for science education and science literacy. But I believe the biggest part of that is, even if everyone doesn't want to learn chemistry, which I hated, I loved astronomy. I hated chemistry and I hate mathematics. But the point is, I respect science. It cannot tell you anything about chemistry. It is baffling to me. It is something I just cannot grasp enough to actually be able to function in any scientific pursuit of it. I listen to chemists.
Yeah.
And that's the difference, is we need to have a culture that goes this, like, look at poor Dr. frickin' Fauci. Literally Captain America. He's like the Jimmy Carter of sick people. He's a million years old and he just wants to be left the hell alone. And he already like worked on saving us from AIDS. And now all of a sudden this pandemic comes out and he gets thrust into the limelight. And what happens? Half the country thinks he's an asshole and gives him death threats because he dared try to save us, because we don't want to listen to the science. We'd rather listen to some orange asshole who wants to tell us what we want to hear. And we need to be okay with uncomfortable truths. We need uncomfortable truths more than we need pleasant lies. And whether or not you understand a certain scientific principle doesn't matter. It's, do you trust the experts, and do you trust in scientific consensus? And that, I think, is where our culture needs to focus.
Amen.
Amen to that. Yeah.
Well, amens all around. Church is concluded. Y'all are great. Thank you so much for joining us here again on the Alt Left. We're really happy you're here. Please come interact with us. Find us on Facebook, on Instagram. You know, we're not just on Podbean. We're all over the place. Our Twitter is fire because Matt is just leading the charge and I'm behind him copying what he does. And speaking of which, Matt, you're usually the one who's on us. You've been handling a lot of our interaction lately.
Yeah, yeah. So we've got shout outs to our listeners that are interacting with us. So the first one is from Instagram user The One and Oldie. And specifically in regards to you, Chris, this is about our latest episode, episode 8, the last one that just dropped regarding income inequality.
Someone stayed awake through that one?
Apparently more than one person, because a lot of people were telling me that they thought it was our best episode yet. And this user, The One and Oldie as well, I have to say that this one has been far from boring and possibly my favorite episode to date. I have been moved by the heart and statements that were made by you three. As a food service worker for my whole career, grocer, butcher, and now a baker slash cook, it was refreshing to have heard validation in my choice. The world has led me to the profession, and every time I think to leave, I'm drawn back to it. It has become a joy and passion with little reward, or at least in what society deems as reward. Completely amazed by Chris's words, I have never been given a good argument as to why another human should have more than another. It moved me. P.S. Thank you for bringing back the history lesson. I'm one of the few who always look forward to them.
I honestly don't think that he's the few. I think there's a lot of people that like the history lesson. I always enjoy it, to be honest.
Agreed. Because even you can always learn more. And even on these where we study for these topics, Chris always manages to come up with something that I have never heard of before. So we always appreciate that, Chris. Thank you.
As someone with a history degree, it's because I read books of people who are smarter than me, not because I'm intrinsically gifted in history. But I'm glad. I'm glad I was able to funnel entertainment.
So this next one is a little bit more general. This is from a YouTube user, fellow podcaster. The channel is CBiz TV. So the letter C, B-I-Z, TV. She's a fellow podcaster. I listen to a couple of her things. They're a little bit more on the religious side for my taste, but they're actually pretty good and well done. She's really great. She's been interacting with us a lot, just giving us comments on all of the clips that we do, giving us shout outs. She wants us to know that, you know, especially on our economics and income inequality episode, that she felt like we were speaking her life in a lot of this stuff. And, I thought that was really poignant and really noteworthy. So shout out to her, because I think for the last several episodes, she's been giving us a lot of shout outs. So I want to show some love. For those of you who are interested in that kind of thing, check her out. Her YouTube channel is CBiz TV on YouTube. Just go ahead and type it in. And those are the big ones that we have so far. The one last thing I did want to announce to be on the lookout for, Chris and I actually had the good fortune to interview a local politician who ran for a council seat in the city of Simi Valley. His name is Phil Luce. We'll be dropping that interview probably within the next week or two, but it was really great to engage with him. Definitely, definitely want to give him a shout out. Phil, you were great. Was glad to have you on that episode.
Absolutely. I look forward to hearing feedback on that one, because I knew of Phil Luce and of his policies. I never gotten to speak with him before, and he is a pleasure. And talk about someone who's actually putting effort and fighting the good fight for the working class people. So I was very glad to have him on. I hope we have him again. I hope he becomes a friend of the show. That's a guy everyone needs to keep an eye on, because he's going places.
Agreed.
So that wraps us up. Every Monday, we are here in your ear holes. Thank you for joining us. We love you. We will see you again here next Monday for another hour and a half of history and economics and arguing about electricity. Please join us. Thank you again. Please take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. And remember, kids, the revolution is you.